looked at them.
"No, I don't think so," she said eventually.
"Fair enough."
I watched cloud formations shimmer in the haze of the power screen for a while, and avoided looking down at the sea below me.
"But I think you want to, really."
"How very male of you."
The food arrived, and we ate in silence, broken only by the traditional slurping. Despite the Hendrix's perfectly balanced auto-chef breakfast, I discovered I was ravenous. The food had triggered a hunger in me deeper than the needs of my stomach. I was draining the dregs of my bowl before Ortega had got halfway through hers.
"Food okay?"
she asked ironically, as I sat back. I nodded, trying to wipe away the skeins of memory associated with the ramen, but unwilling to bring the onboy conditioning online and spoil the sated feeling in my belly. Looking around at the clean metal lines of the dining gantry and the sky beyond, I was as close to totally contented as I had been since Miriam Bancroft left me drained in the Hendrix. Ortega's phone shrilled. She unpocketed it and answered, still chewing her last mouthful.
"Yeah? Uh-huh. Uh-huh, good. No, we'll go."
Her eyes flickered briefly to mine.
"That so? No, leave that one, too. It'll keep."
"Yeah. Thanks, Zach. Owe you one." She stowed the phone again and resumed eating.
"Good news?"
"Depends on your point of view. They traced the two local calls, one to a fight drone over in Richmond, place I know. We'll go down and take a look."
"And the other call?"
Ortega looked up at me from her bowl, chewed and swallowed.
"The other number was a residential discreet. Bancroft residence. Sun Touch House. Now what exactly do you make of that?"
Chapter 19. Ortega's fight drone was an ancient bulk carrier, moored up in the north end of the bay, alongside acres of abandoned warehouses. The vessel must have been over a half a kilometer long, with six clearly discernible cargo cells between stem and stern. The one at the rear appeared to be open. From the air, the body of the carrier was a uniform orange that I assumed was rust.
"Don't let it fool you," Ortega grunted as we circled. "They've polymered the hull a quarter meter thick all over. Take a shaped charge to sink it now."
"Expensive."
She shrugged.
"They've got the backing."
We landed on the quay. Ortega killed the motors and leaned across me to peer up at the ship's superstructure, which, at a glance, appeared to be deserted. I pushed myself back into the seat a little, discomforted in equal parts by the pressure of the lithe torso in my lap and my slightly overfull stomach. She felt the movement, seemed suddenly to realize what she was doing, and pulled herself abruptly upright again.
"No one home,"
she said awkwardly.
"So it seems. Shall we go and have a look?"
We got out into the customary blanket snap of wind off the bay and made for a tubular aluminum gangway that led onto the vessel near the stern. It was uncomfortably open ground, and I crossed it with an eye constantly sweeping the railed and craned lines of the ship's deck and bridge tower. Nothing stirred. I squeezed my left arm lightly against my side to check that the fiber grip holster hadn't slipped down, as the cheaper varieties often did after a couple of days' wear. With the Nemex, I was tolerably sure I could air out anyone shooting at us from the rail. In any event, it wasn't necessary. We reached the end of the gangway without incident. A slim chain was fixed across the open entrance with a hand-lettered sign hung on it. Panama Rose. Fight tonight, 2200. Gate price double. I lifted the rectangle of thin metal and looked at the crude lettering dubiously.
"Are you sure Rutherford called here?"
"Like I said, don't let it fool you."
Ortega was unhooking the chain.
"Fighter chic. Crude's the in thing. Last season it was neon signs, but even that's not cool enough now. Place is fucking globally hyped. Only about three or four like it on the planet. There's no coverage allowed in the arenas. No hollows, not even televisuals. You coming or what?"
"Weird."
I followed her down the tubular corridor, thinking of the freak fights I'd gone to when I was younger. On Harlan's world, all fights were broadcast. They got the highest viewing figures of any transmitted entertainment online.
Don't people like watching this sort of stuff?
Yes, of course they do.
Even with the distortion of the echoing corridor, I could hear Ortega's lip curling in the tone of her voice.
Never get enough of it. That's how this scam works. See, first they set up the creed.
Creed?
Yeah, creed of purity or some such shit. Didn't anyone ever tell you it's rude to interrupt? Creed goes, you want to see the fight, you go see it in the flesh.
That's better than watching it on the web. More classy.
So limited audience seating, sky-high demand. That makes the tickets very sexy, which makes them very expensive, which makes them even more sexy, and whoever thought of it just rides that spiral up through the roof.
Smart.
Yeah, smart.
We came to the end of the gangway and stepped out again onto a wind-whipped deck. On either side of us, the roofing of two of the cargo cells swelled smoothly to waist height like two enormous steel blisters on the ship's skin. Beyond the rear swelling, the bridge towered blankly into the sky, seeming entirely unconnected with the hull we were standing on. The only motion came from the chains of a loading crane ahead of us that the wind had set swinging fractionally.
"The last time I was out here,"
Ortega said, raising her voice to compete with the wind,
"was because some dipshit news prick from World Web One got caught trying to walk recording implants into a title fight. They threw him into the bay, after they'd removed the implants with a pair of pliers."
Nice.
"Like I said, it's a classy place."
"Such flattery, Lieutenant. I hardly know how to respond."
The voice coughed from rusty-looking loudspeaker horns set on 2-meter-high stalks along the rail. My hand flew to the Namek's butt, and my vision cycled out to peripheral scan with a rapidity that hurt. Ortega gave me an almost imperceptible shake of the head and looked up at the bridge. The two of us swept the superstructure for movement in opposite directions, coordinating unconsciously. Under the immediacy of the tension, I felt a warm shiver of pleasure at that unlooked-for symmetry.
"No, no, over here,"
the metallic voice said, this time relegated to the horns to the stern. As I watched, the chains on one of the rear loading cranes grated into motion and began to run, presumably hauling something up from the open cell in front of the bridge. I left my hand on the Nemex. Overhead, the sun was breaking through the cloud cover. The chain ended in a massive iron hook, in the crook of which stood the speaker, one hand still holding a prehistoric microphone, the other gripped lightly around the rising chain. He was dressed in an inappropriate-looking gray suit that flapped in the wind, leaning out from the chain at a fastidious angle, hair glinting in a wandering shaft of sunlight. I narrowed my eyes to confirm. Synthetic. Cheap synthetic. The crane swung out over the curved cover of the cargo cell, and the synth alighted elegantly on the top, looking down on us.
"Elias Riker," he said,
and his voice was not much smoother than the tannoy had been. Someone had done a real cut-rate job on the vocal cords. He shook his head.
"We thought we'd seen the last of you. How short the legislature's memory." "Carnage?"
Ortega lifted a hand to shade against the sudden sunlight.
"That you?"
The synthetic bowed faintly and stowed the mic inside his jacket. He began to pick his way down the sloping cell cover.
"M.C. Carnage, at your service, officers. And pray, what have we done to offend today?"
I said nothing. From the sound of it, I was supposed to know this Carnage, and I didn't have enough to work with at the moment. Remembering what Ortega had told me, I fixed the approaching synth with a blank stare, and hoped I was being sufficiently Riker-like. The synthetic reached the edge of the cell cover and jumped down. Up close, I saw that it wasn't only the vocal cords that were crude. This body was so far from the one Trep had been using when I torched her, it was barely deserving of the same name. I wondered briefly if it was some kind of antique. The black hair was coarse and enameled-looking. The face, slack silico flesh. The pale blue eyes clearly logoed across the white. The body looked solid, but a little too solid, and the arms were slightly wrong, reminiscent of snakes rather than limbs. The hands at the ends of the cuffs were smooth and lineless. The synth offered one featureless palm, as if for inspection.
"Well?" he asked gently.
"Routine check, Carnage," Ortega said, helping me out. "Been some bomb threats on tonight's fight. We're here to have a look."
Carnage laughed jarringly.
"As if you cared."
"Well, like I said," Ortega answered evenly, "it's routine."
"Oh, well, you'd better come along, then."
The synthetic sighed and nodded at me.
"What's the matter with him? Did they lose his speech functions in the stack?"
We followed him toward the back of the ship and found ourselves skirting the pit formed by the rolled-back cover of the rearmost cargo cell. I glanced down inside and saw a circular white fighting ring, walled on four sides by slopes of steel and plastic seating. Banks of lighting equipment were strung above, but they were none of the spiky spherical units I associated with telemetry. In the center of the ring, someone was kneeling, painting a design on the mat by hand, and looked up as we passed.
"Thematic," Carnage said, seeing where I was looking, "means something in Arabic. This season's fights are all themed around protectorate police actions. Tonight it's Sharia, right hand of God martyrs versus Protect Marines, hand to hand, no blades over 10 centimeters.
"Bloodbath, in other words," Ortega said. The synth shrugged.
"What the public wants, the public pays for. I understand it is possible to inflict an outright mortal wound with a 10-centimeter blade, just very difficult. A real test of skill, they say. This way."
We went down a narrow companionway into the body of the ship, our own footsteps clanging around us in the tight confines.
"Arenas first, I presume,"
Carnage shouted above the echoes.
"No, let's see the tanks first,"
Ortega suggested.
"Really?"
It was hard to tell with a low-grade synthetic voice, but Carnage seemed to be amused.
"Are you quite sure it's a bomb you're looking for, Lieutenant? It seems to me the arena would be the obvious place to..."
"Got something to hide, Carnage?"
The synthetic turned back to look at me for a moment, quizzically.
"No, not at all, Detective Riker. The tanks it is, then. Welcome to the conversation, by the way. Was it cold on stack? Of course, you probably never expected to be there yourself."
"That's enough," Ortega interposed herself. "Just take us to the tanks and save the small talk for tonight."
"But, of course, we aim to cooperate with law enforcement as a legally incorporated..."
"Yeah, yeah,"
Ortega waved the verbiage away with weary patience.
"Just take us to the fucking tanks."
I reverted to my dangerous stare. We rode to the tank area in a dinky little electromag train that ran along one side of the hull, through two more converted cargo cells equipped with the same fighting rings and banks of seats, but this time covered over with plastic sheeting. At the far end, we disembarked and stepped through the customary sonic cleansing lock. A great deal dirtier than Psychosec's facilities. Ostensibly made of black iron, the heavy door swung outward to reveal a spotlessly white interior.
"At this point we dispense with image," Carnage said carelessly. "Bare-bones low-tech is all very well for the audience, but behind the scenes, well..."
He gestured around at the gleaming facilities.
"You can't make an omelet without a little oil in the pan."
The forward cargo section was huge and chilly, the lighting gloomy, the technology aggressively massive. Where Bancroft's low-lit womb mausoleum at Psychosec had spoken in soft, cultured tones of the trappings of wealth, where the resleeving room at Bay City Storage Facility had groaned minimal funding from minimal deservers, the Panama Rosa's body bank was a brutal growl of power. The storage tubes were racked on heavy chains like torpedoes on either side of us, jacked into a central monitor system at one end of the hold via thick black cables that twisted across the floor like pythons. The monitor unit itself squatted heavily ahead of us, like an altar to some unpleasant spider god. We approached it on a metal jetty raised a quarter meter above the frozen writhings of the data cables. Behind it to the left and right, set into the far wall, were the square glass sides of two spacious decanting tanks. The right-hand tank already held a sleeve, floating backlit and tethered cruciform by monitor lines. It was like walking into the Andra Cathedral in New Pest. Carnage walked to the central monitor, turned, and spread his arms rather like the sleeve above and behind him.
Where would you like to start? I assume you've brought sophisticated bomb detection equipment with you.
Ortega ignored him. She took a couple of steps closer to the decanting tank and looked up into the wash of cool green light it cast down into the gloom.
"This one of tonight's whores?" she asked.
Carnage sniffed.
"In not so many words, it is. I do wish you'd understand the difference between what they peddle in those greasy little shops down the coast and this."
"So do I," Ortega told him, eyes still upward on the body.
"Where'd you get this one, then?"
"How should I know?" Carnage made a show of studying the plastic nails on his right hand.
"Oh, we have the bill of sale somewhere, if you must look. By the look of him, I'd say this one's out of Nippon Organics, or one of the Pacific Rim combines. Does it really matter?"
I went to the wall and stared up at the floating sleeve. Slim, hard-looking, and brown, with the delicately lifted Japanese eyes on the shelf of unscalably high cheekbones, a thick, straight drift of impenetrably black hair like seaweed in the tank fluid. Gracefully flexible with the long hands of an artist, but muscled for speed combat. It was the body of a tech ninja, the body I'd dreamed about having at 15, on dreary, rain-filled days in New Pest. It wasn't far off the sleeve they'd given me to fight the Sharia war in. It was a variation on the sleeve I'd bought with my first big payoff in Millsport, the sleeve I'd met Sarah in. It was like looking at myself under glass, the self I'd built somewhere in the coils of memory that trail all the way back to childhood. Suddenly, I stood, exiled into Caucasian flesh, on the wrong side of the mirror. Carnage came up to me and slapped the glass.
"You approve, Detective Riker?"
When I said nothing, he went on.
"I'm sure you do, someone with your appetite for, well, brawling. The specs are quite remarkable. Reinforced chassis. The bones are all culture-grown marrow alloy jointed with polybond ligamenting, carbon-reinforced tendons, Kumalo Nurikem."
"Gut Nurikem," I said, for something to say.
"I know all about your Nurikem, Detective Riker."
Even through the poor quality voice, I thought I could hear a soft, sticky delight.
"The fight drones scanned your specs when you were on stack. There was some talk of buying you up, you know. Physically, I mean. It was thought your sleeve could be used in a humiliation bout. Faked, of course. We would never dream of the actual thing here. That would be, well, criminal."
Carnage paused dramatically.
"But then it was decided that humiliation fights were not the, the spirit of the establishment. A lowering of tone, you understand. Not a real contest. Shame, really. With all the friends you've made, it would have been a big crowd-puller."
I wasn't really listening to him, but it dawned on me that Riker was being insulted, and I pivoted away from the glass to fix Carnage with what seemed like an appropriate glare.
"But I digress," the synthetic went on smoothly. "What I meant to say is that your Nurikem is to this system, as my voice is to that of Ankana Salamau. This," he gestured once more at the tank, "is Kumalo Nurikem, patented by Cape Neuronics only last year, a development of almost spiritual proportions. There are no synaptic chemical amplifiers, no servo chips or implanted wiring. The system is grown in, and it responds directly to thought. Consider that, Detective. No one off-world has it yet. The UN is thought to be considering a 10-year colonial embargo, though I myself doubt the efficacy of such..."
"Carnage!" Ortega drifted in behind him impatiently.
"Why haven't you decanted the other fighter yet?" "But we are, Lieutenant."
Carnage waved one hand at the rack of body tubes on the left. From behind them came the sound of prowling heavy machinery. I peered into the gloom and made out a big automated forklift unit rolling down the rows of containers. As we watched, it locked to a stop, and bright directed lighting sprang up on its frame. The forks reached and clamped on a tube, extracting it from the chained cradle while smaller servos disconnected the cabling from it. Separation complete, the machine withdrew slightly, swiveled about, and trundled back along the rows toward the empty decanting tank.
"The system is entirely automated," Carnage said superfluously.
Below the tank, I now noticed a line of three circular openings, like the forward discharge ports of an IP dreadnought. The forklift rose up a little on hydraulic pistons, and loaded the tube it was carrying smoothly into the center port. The tube fit snugly, the visible end rotating through about 90 degrees before a steel baffle slammed down over it. The task completed, the forklift sank back down on its hydraulics, and its engines died. I watched the tank. It seemed like a while, but in fact probably took less than a minute. A hatch broke open in the floor of the tank, and a silvery shoal of bubbles erupted upward. Drifting after them came the body. It bobbed fetally for a moment, turning this way and that in the eddies caused by the air. Then its arms and legs began to unfold, aided by the gently tugging monitor wires secured at wrist and ankle. It was bigger bone than the Kamalo sleeve, blocky and more heavily muscled, but similar in color. A strong-boned, hawk-nosed visage tipped lazily toward us as the thin wires pulled it upright.
"Sharian, right hand of God, martyr," Carnage said beamingly. "Not really, of course, but the race type's accurate, and it's got an authentic will-of-God-enhanced response system."
He nodded at the other tank.
"The Marines on Sharia were multiracial, but there were enough Jap types there to make it believable."
"Not much of a contest, is it?" I said. "State-of-the-art Neurochem against century-old Sharian biomech."
Carnage grinned with his slack, silico-flesh face. "Well, that will depend on the fighters. I'm told the Kamalo system takes a bit of getting used to, and to be honest, it isn't always the best sleeve that wins. It's more about psychology. Endurance. Pain tolerance."
"Savagery," Ortega added. "Lack of empathy."
"Things like that," the synthetic agreed. "That's what makes it exciting, of course. If you'd care to come tonight, Lieutenant, Detective, I'm sure I can find you a couple of remaindered seats near the back."
"You'll be commentating?" I surmised, already hearing the Spec's rich vocabulary that Carnage used come tumbling out over the loudspeaker, the killing ring drenched in focused white light, the roaring, surging crowd in the darkened seating, the smell of sweat and bloodlust.
"Of course I will." Carnage's logoed eyes narrowed. "You haven't been away so long, you know." "Are we going to look for these bombs?"
Ortega said loudly. It took us over an hour to go over the hold, looking for imaginary bombs, while Carnage looked on with poorly veiled amusement. Up above, the two sleeves destined for slaughter in the arena looked down on us from their green-lit glass-sided wombs, and their presences weighed no less heavily for their closed eyes and dreaming visages.
Chapter 20. Ortega dropped me on Mission Street as evening was falling over the city. She'd been withdrawn and monosyllabic on the flight back from the fight drone, and I guessed the strain of reminding herself I was not Riker was beginning to take a toll. But when I made a production out of brushing off my shoulders as I got out of the cruiser, she laughed impulsively.
"Stick around the Hendrix tomorrow," she said. "There's someone I want you to talk to, but it'll take a while to set up."
"Fair enough." I turned to go.
"Kovach."
I turned back. She was leaning across to look up and out of the open door at me. I put an arm on the uplifted door wing of the cruiser and looked down. There was a longish pause during which I could feel my blood beginning to adrenalize gently.
"Yes?"
She hesitated a moment longer, then said, "Carnage was hiding something back there, right?" "From the amount he talked, I'd say yes."
"That's what I thought."
She prodded hurriedly at the control console, and the door began to slide back down.
"See you tomorrow."
I watched the cruiser lift into the sky and sighed. I was reasonably sure that going to Ortega openly had been a good move, but I hadn't expected it to be so messy. However long she and Riker had been together, the chemistry must have been devastating. I remembered reading somewhere how the initial pheromones of attraction between bodies appeared to undergo a form of encoding the longer said bodies were in proximity, binding them increasingly close. None of the biochemists interviewed appeared to really understand the process, but there had been some attempts to play with it in labs. Speeding up or interrupting had met with mixed results, one of which was empathin and its derivatives. Chemicals. I was still reeling from the cocktail of Miriam Bancroft, and I didn't need this. I told myself in no uncertain terms I didn't need this. Up ahead, over the heads of the evening's scattered pedestrians, I saw the holographic bulk of the left-handed guitar player outside the Hendrix. I sighed again and started walking. Halfway up the block, a bulky automated vehicle rolled past me, hugging the curb. It looked pretty much like the robo-crawlers that cleaned the streets of Millsport, so I paid no attention to it as it drew level. Seconds later, I was drenched in the machine's image cast.
From the houses, 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 from the houses.
The voices groaned and murmured, male, female, overlaid. It was like a choir in the throes of orgasm. The images were inescapable, varying across a broad spectrum of sexual preference, a whirlwind of fleeting sensory impressions. Genuine. Uncut. Full-sense repro. Tailored. As if to prove this last, the random images thinned out into a stream of heterosex combinations. They must have scanned my response to the blur of options and fed directly back to the broadcast unit. Very high-tech. The flow ended with a phone number in glowing numerals and an erect penis in the hands of a woman with long, dark hair and a crimson-lipped smile. She looked into the lens. I could feel her fingers.
"Head in the clouds," she breathed. "This is what it's like. Maybe you can't afford to come up here, but you can certainly afford this."
Her head dipped. Her lips slid down over the penis. Like it was happening to me. Then the long black hair curtained in from either side and inked the image out. I was back on the street, swaying, coated in a thin sheen of sweat. The autocaster grumbled away down the street behind me, some of the more streetwise pedestrians skipping sharply sideways out of its cast radius. I found I could recall the phone number with gleaming clarity. The sweat cooled rapidly to a shiver. I flexed my shoulders and started walking, trying not to notice the knowing looks of the people around me. I was almost into a full stride again when a gap opened in the strollers ahead, and I saw the long, low limousine parked outside the Hendrix's front doors. Jangling nerves sent my hand leaping toward the holstered Nemex before I recognized the vehicle as Bancroft's. Forcing out a deep breath, I circled the limousine and ascertained that the driver's compartment was empty. I was still wondering what to do when the rear compartment hatch cracked open, and Curtis unfolded himself from the seating inside.
"We need to talk, Kovach,"
he said in a man-to-man sort of voice that put me on the edge of a slightly hysterical giggle.
"Decision time."
I looked him up and down, reckoned from the tiny eddies in his stance and demeanor that he was chemically augmented at the moment, and decided to humor him.
"Sure. In the limo?"
"It's cramped in there. How about you ask me up to your room?"
My eyes narrowed. There was an unmistakable hostility in the chauffeur's voice, and a just as unmistakable hard-on pressing at the front of his immaculate chinos. Granted, I had a similar, if detumescing, lump of my own, but I remembered distinctly that Bancroft's limo had shielding against the streetcasts. This was something else. I nodded at the hotel entrance.
"Okay, let's go."
The doors parted to let us in, and the Hendrix came to life.
"Good evening, sir. You have no visitors this evening."
Curtis snorted.
"Disappointed, huh, Kovach?" "Nor any calls since you left,"
the hotel continued smoothly.
"Do you wish this person admitted as a guest?"
"Yeah, sure. You got a bar we can go to?"
"I said your room,"
Curtis growled behind me, then yelped as he barked his shin on one of the lobby's low, metal-edged tables.
"The Midnight Lamp Bar is located on this floor," the hotel said doubtfully. but it has not been used for a considerable time.
I said...
Shut up, Curtis. Didn't anyone ever tell you not to rush a first date? The midnight lamp is fine. Fire it up for us. Across the lobby, adjacent to the check-in console, a wide section of the back wall slid grudgingly aside, and lights flickered on in the space beyond. With Curtis making sneering sounds behind me, I went to the opening and peered down a short flight of steps into the midnight lamp bar. This'll do fine. Come on. Someone over-literal in imagination had done the interior decoration of the midnight lamp bar. The walls, themselves psychedelic whirls of midnight blues and purples, were festooned with a variety of clock faces showing either the declared hour or a few minutes too, interwoven with every form of lamp known to man, from clay prehistoric to enzyme decay light canisters. There was indented bench seating along both walls, clock-face tables, and in the center of the room a circular bar in the shape of a countdown dial. A robot composed entirely of clocks and lamps waited immobile just beside the dial's 12 mark. It was all the more eerie for the complete absence of any other customers, and as we made our way toward the waiting robot, I could feel Curtis's earlier mood quiet a little. "What will it be, gentlemen?" the machine said unexpectedly, from no apparent vocal outlet. Its face was an antique white analog clock with spider-thin Baroque hands and the hours marked off in Roman numerals. A little unnerved, I turned back to Curtis, whose face was showing signs of unwilling sobriety.
"Vodka," he said shortly. "Sub-zero."
"And a whiskey. Whatever it is I've been drinking out of the cabinet in my room. At room temperature, please. Both on my tab."
The clock face inclined slightly, and one multi-jointed arm swung up to select glasses from an overhead rack. The other arm, which ended in a lamp with a forest of small spouts, trickled the requested spirits into the glasses. Curtis picked up his glass and threw a generous portion of the vodka down his throat. He drew breath hard through his teeth and made a satisfied growling noise. I sipped at my own glass a little more circumspectly, wondering how long it had been since liquid last flowed through the bar's tubes and spigots. My fears proved unfounded, so I deepened the sip and let the whiskey melt its way down into my stomach. Curtis banged down his glass.
"Now you ready to talk?"
"All right, Curtis," I said slowly, looking into my drink. "I imagine you have a message for me."
"Sure have." His voice was cranked to snapping point. "The lady says you're going to take her very generous offer or not. Just that. I'm supposed to give you time to make up your mind, so I'll finish my drink."
I fixed my gaze on a Martian sand lamp hanging from the opposite wall. Curtis's mood was beginning to make some sense. "Muscling in on your territory, am I?"
"Don't push your luck, Kovach."
There was a desperate edge to the words.
"You say the wrong thing here and I'll..."
"You'll what?" I set my glass down and turned to face him. He was less than half my subjective age, young and muscled and chemically wound up in the illusion that he was dangerous. He reminded me so much of myself at the same age, it was maddening. I wanted to shake him.
"You'll what?"
Curtis gulped.
"I was in the Provincial Marines."
"What as, a pin-up?" I went to push him in the chest with one stiffened hand, then dropped it, ashamed. I lowered my voice. "Listen, Curtis, don't do this to us both."
"You think you're pretty fucking tough, don't you?"
"This isn't about tough, Curtis." I'd almost called him kid. It seemed as if part of me wanted the fight after all. "This is about two different species. What did they teach you in the Provincial Marines? Hand-to-hand combat? 27 ways to kill a man with your hands? Underneath it all, you're still a man. I'm an envoy, Curtis. It's not the same." He came for me anyway, leading with a straight jab that was supposed to distract me, while the following roundhouse kick scythed in from the side at head height. It was a skullcracker if it landed, but it was hopelessly overdramatic. Maybe it was the chemicals he'd dressed up in that night. No one in their right mind throws kicks above the waist height in a real fight.
I ducked the jab and the kick in the same movement and grabbed his foot. A sharp twist and Curtis tipped, staggered, and landed spread-eagled on the bar top. I smashed his face against the unyielding surface and held him there with my hand knotted in his hair. See what I mean? He made muffled noises and thrashed impotently about while the clock-faced bartender stood immobile. Blood from his broken nose was streaked across the bar's surface. I studied the patterns it had made while I brought my breathing back down. The lock I had on my conditioning was making me pant. Shifting my grip to his right arm, I jerked it up high into the small of his back. The thrashing stopped. Good. Now you keep still or I'll break it. I'm not in the mood for this. As I spoke, I was feeling rapidly through his pockets. In the inner breast pouch of his jacket, I found a small plastic tube. Aha! So what little delights have we got tubing around your system tonight? Hormone enhancers, by the look of that hard on. I held the tube up to dim light and saw thousands of tiny crystal slivers inside. Military format. Where did you get this stuff, Curtis? Discharge freebie from the Marines, was it? I recommenced my search and came up with a delivery system. A tiny skeletal gun with a sliding chamber and a magnetic coil. Tip the crystals into the breech and close it. The magnetic field aligns them, and the accelerator spits them out at penetrative speed. Not so different from Sarah's shard pistol. For battlefield medics, they were a hardy and consequently very popular alternative to hyposprays. I hauled Curtis to his feet and shoved him away from me. He managed to stay on his feet, clutching at his nose with one hand and glaring at me. "You want to tip your head back to stop that," I told him. "Go ahead. I'm not going to hurt you again."
"Motherfucker!"
I held up the crystals and the little gun. "Where did you get these?"
"Suck my prick, Kovach."
Curtis tipped his head back fractionally, despite himself, trying to keep me in view at the same time. His eyes rolled in their sockets like a panicked horse's.
"I'm not telling you a fucking thing."
"Fair enough." I put the chemicals back on the bar and regarded him gravely for a couple of seconds. "Then let me tell you something instead. When they make an envoy, do you want to know what they do? They burn out every evolved violence limitation instinct in the human psyche. Submission signal recognition, pecking order dynamics, pack loyalties, it all goes, tuned out a neuron at a time, and they replace it with a conscious will to harm." He stared back at me in silence. "Do you understand me? It would have been easier to kill you just then. It would have been easier. I had to stop myself. That's what an envoy is, Curtis. A reassembled human. An artifice." The silence stretched. There was no way to know if he was taking it in or not. Thinking back to New Pest a century and a half ago, and the young Takashi Kovach, I doubted he was. At his age, the whole thing would have sounded like a dream of power come true. I shrugged. "In case you hadn't guessed already, the answer to the lady's question is no. I'm not interested." "There, that should make you happy. And it only cost you a broken nose to find out. If you hadn't dosed yourself to the eyes, it might not even have cost that much." "Tell her thank you very much. The offer is appreciated. But there's too much going on here to walk away from. Tell her I'm starting to enjoy it." There was a slight cough from the entrance to the bar. I looked up and saw a suited, crimson-haired figure on the stairs. "Am I interrupting something?" the Mohican inquired. The voice was slow and relaxed. Not one of the heavies from Fell Street. I picked up my drink from the bar. "Not at all, officer. Come on down and join the party. What'll you have?" "Overproof rum," the cop said, drifting over to us. "If they got it, small glass." I raised a finger at the clock face. The bartender produced a square-cut glass from somewhere and filled it with a deep red liquid. The Mohican ambled past Curtis, sparing him a curious glance on the way, and apprehended the drink with a long arm. "Appreciated." He sifted the drink and inclined his head. "Not bad. I'd like a word with you, Kovach. In private." We both glanced at Curtis. The chauffeur glared back at me with hate-filled eyes, but the new arrival had defused the confrontation. The cop jerked his head in the direction of the exit. Curtis went, still clutching his wounded face. The cop watched him out of sight before he turned back to me.
"You do that?"
he asked casually. I nodded. Provoked. Things got a bit out of hand. He thought he was protecting someone.
Well, I'm glad he ain't protecting me.
Like I said, it got a bit out of hand. I overreacted.
Hell, you don't need to explain yourself to me.
The cop leaned on the bar and looked around him with frank interest. I recalled his face now. Bay City Storage. The one with a quick tarnishing badge.
He feels aggrieved enough he can press charges, and we'll play back some more of this place's memory. Got your warrant, then?
I put the question with a lightness I didn't feel.
Almost. Always takes a while with the legal department. Fucking AIs. Look, I wanted to apologize for Mercer and Davidson, the way they were at the station. They act like a brace of dickheads sometimes, but they're fundamentally okay.
I waved my glass laterally.
Forget it. Good. I'm Rodrigo Batista, detective sergeant. Ortega's partner most of the time.
He drained his glass and grinned at me.
Loosely attached, I should point out.
Noted. I signaled the bartender for refills.
Tell me something. You guys all go to the same hairdresser, or is it some kind of team bonding thing?
Same hairdresser.
Batista shrugged sorrowfully.
Old guy up on Fulton. Ex-con. Apparently Mohicans were cool back when they threw him in the store.
It's the only goddamn style he knows, but he's a nice old guy, and he's cheap. One of us started going there a few years back. He gave us discounts. You know how it is.
But not Ortega.
Ortega cuts her own hair.
Batista made a what-can-you-do gesture.
Got a little holocaust scanner. Says it improves her spatial coordination or some such shit.
Different.
Yeah, she is.
Batista paused reflectively, gaze soaking up the middle distance. He sipped absently at his freshened drink.
It's her I'm here about.
Uh-oh. Is this going to be a friendly warning? Batista pulled a face.
Well, it's going to be friendly, whatever you call it. I ain't looking for a broken nose.
I laughed despite myself. Batista joined me with a gentle smile.
Thing is, it's tearing her up, you walking around with that face on. She and Riker were real close. She's been paying the sleeve mortgage a year now, and on a lieutenant's pay, that ain't an easy thing to do. Never figured on an overbid like that fucker Bancroft pulled. After all, Riker ain't exactly young, and he never was a beauty.
Got Nurikam, I pointed out.
Oh, sure, got Nurikam.
Batista waved an arm with largesse.
You tried it yet?
Couple of times.
Like dancing flamenco on a fishing net, right?
It's a little rough, I admitted.
This time we both laughed. When it cranked down, the cop focused on his glass again. His face grew serious.
I ain't trying to lean on you. All I'm saying is, go easy. This ain't exactly what she needs right now.
Me neither, I said feelingly. This isn't even my fucking planet. Batista looked sympathetic, or maybe just slightly drunk.
Holland's world's a lot different from this, I guess.
You guess right.
Look, I don't mean to be unsubtle, but hasn't anyone pointed out to Ortega that Riker's is gone for good as it gets without real death? She's not looking to wait 200 years for him, is she?
The cop looked at me through narrowed eyes.
You heard about Riker, huh?
I know he's down for the double barrel. I know what he went down for. Batista got something in his eyes then that looked like shards of old pain. It can't be much fun talking about your corrupt colleagues. For a moment, I regretted what I'd said. Local color. Soak it up.
You want to sit down?
The cop said unhappily, casting around for bar stools that had evidently been removed at some stage.
Over in the booths, maybe? This'll take a while to tell.
We settled at one of the clock-face tables, and Batista fumbled in his pocket for cigarettes. I twitched, but when he offered me one, I shook my head. Like Ortega, he looked surprised.
I quit.
In that sleeve?
Bautista's eyebrows lifted respectfully behind a veil of fragrant blue smoke. Congratulations.
Thanks. You were going to tell me about Riker.
Riker.
The cop jetted smoke out of his nostrils and sat back.
Was working with the sleeve theft boys until a couple of years ago. They're quite a sophisticated bunch compared to us. It ain't so easy to steal a whole sleeve intact, and that breeds a smarter class of criminal. There's some crossover of jurisdiction with organic damage, mostly when they start breaking down the bodies. Places like the Y Clinic.
Oh?
I said neutrally.
Bautista nodded.
Yeah. Someone saved us an awful lot of time and effort over there yesterday. Turned the place into a spare parts sale. But I guess you wouldn't know anything about that.
Must have happened as I was walking out the door.
Yeah, well, anyway, back in the winter of 09, Riker was chasing down some random insurance fraud. You know the stuff where re-sleeve policy clones turn out to be empty tanks and no one knows where the bodies went. It split wide open, and turns out the bodies are being used for some dirty little war down south. High-level corruption. It bounced all the way up to UN Presidium level and back. A few token heads roll, and Riker gets to be a hero.
Nice.
In the short term, yeah. The way it works around here, heroes get a very high profile, and they went the whole program for Riker. Interviews on World Web One, highly publicized fling with Sandy Kim even, bylines in the faxes. Before all could tail off, Riker grabbed his chance. Put in for a transfer to Orgdam. He'd worked with Ortega a couple times before. Like I said, we overlap here and there, so he knew the program. No way could the department turn him down, especially with some bullshit speech he made about wanting to go where he could make a difference.
And did he? Make a difference, I mean?
Bautista puffed out his cheeks.
He was a good cop. Maybe. A month in, you could have asked Ortega that question. But then the two of them hooked up, and her judgment went all to pieces.
You don't approve?
Okay, what's to approve? You feel that way about someone, you go with it. Just makes it tough to get any objectivity on this thing. When Riker fucked up, Ortega was bound to side with him.
Did she?
I took our empty glasses to the bar and got them refilled, still talking.
I thought she brought him in.
Where'd you hear that?
Talk. Not a massively reputable source.
It's not true, then?
Nah.
Some of the street slime like to talk it up that way. I think the idea of us ratting each other out makes them cream their pants. What happened was, internal affairs took Riker down in her apartment.
Oh.
Yeah. Ain't that a laser up the ass? Bautista looked at me as I handed him his new drink. She never let it show, you know, just went right to work against the IAD charges. From what I heard, they had him cold.
Yeah, your source got that bit right.
The Mohican looked into his glass pensively, as if unsure he should go on. Ortega's theory was that Riker was set up by some high-ranking asshole who took a fall back in 09.
And it's true, he upset a lot of people.
But you don't buy it?
I'd like to. Like I said, he was a good cop. But like I also said, sleeve theft was dealing to a smarter class of criminal, and that meant you had to be careful.
Smart criminals have smart lawyers, and you can't bounce them around whenever you feel like it. Organic damage handles everyone, from the scum on up. Generally, we get a bit more leeway. That was what what Riker wanted when he transferred. The leeway.
Bautista tipped back his glass and set it down with a throat-clearing noise. He looked at me steadily.
I think Riker got carried away.
Blam, blam, blam.
Something like that. I've seen him interrogate before. He's right on the line most of the time.
One slip. There was an old terror in Bautista's eyes now. The fear he lived with every day.
With some of these turds, it's real easy to lose your cool. So easy.
I think that's what happened.
My source says he RD'd two and left another two of their stacks still intact.
That sounds pretty fucking careless.
Bautista jerked his head affirmatively.
What Ortega says. But it won't wash. See, it all went down in a black clinic up in Seattle.
The two intacts made it out of the building breathing, grabbed the cruiser and flew. Riker put 124 holes in that cruiser when it lifted, not to mention the surrounding traffic. The intacts ditched in the Pacific. One of them died at the controls, the other one in the impact. Sank in a couple of 100 meters of water. Riker was out of his jurisdiction, and the Seattle cops ain't all that keen on out-of-town badges shooting up the traffic, so the retrieval teams never let him close to the bodies. Everyone was real surprised when the stacks came up Catholic, and someone at the Seattle PD wasn't buying. Dig a little bit deeper, and it turns out the reasons of conscience decals are fake, dipped in by someone real careless, or in a real hurry. Bautista snapped his fingers and pointed a finger across the table at me. He was definitely a little drunk now. There you go. The way IAD read it, Riker'd screwed up letting the witnesses escape, and his only hope was to slap a do-not-disturb sign on the stacks. Of course, when they did bring back the intacts, they both swore blind that Riker had turned up without a warrant, bluffed and then smashed his way into the clinic, and when they wouldn't answer his questions, started playing Who's Next with a plasma gun. Was it true? About the warrant? Yeah. Riker had no business being up there in the first place. About the rest, who knows. What did Riker say? He said he didn't do it. Just that? Nah, it was a long story. He'd gone up on a tip, bluffed himself inside just to see how far he could push it, and suddenly they were shooting at him. Claims he might have taken someone out, but probably not with a headshot. Claims the clinic must have brought in two sacrificial employees and torched them before he arrived. Claims he knows nothing about any dipping that went on. Bautista shrugged blearily. They found the dipper, and he said Riker paid him to do it. Polygraph tested. But he also says Riker called him up. Didn't do it face to face. Virtual link. Which can be faked. Easily. Yeah. Bautista looked pleased. But then this guy says he's done work for Riker before, this time face to face. And he polygraphed out on that, too. Riker knows him, that's indisputable. And then, of course, IAD wanted to know why Riker didn't take any backup with him. They got witnesses in the street who said Riker was like a maniac, shooting blind, trying to bring the cruiser down. Seattle PD didn't take too kindly to that. Like I said, 124 holes, I muttered. Yep, that's a lot of holes. Riker wanted to bring those two intacts down pretty badly. It could have been a setup. Yeah, it could have been. Bautista sobered up a little, and his voice got angry. Could have been a lot of things. But the fact is that you... Shit, sorry. The fact is that Riker went too far out. And when the branch broke, there was no one there to catch him. So Ortega buys the setup story, stands by Riker, and fights IAD all the way down. And when they lose, I nodded to myself. When they lose, she picks up the sleeve mortgage to keep Riker's body out of the city auction room. And goes looking for fresh evidence? Got it in one. She's already lodged an appeal, but there's a minimum 2-year elapse from start of sentence before she can get the disc spinning. Bautista let go of a gut-deep sigh. Like I said, it's tearing her up. We sat quietly for a while. You know, Bautista said finally, I think I'm gonna go. Sitting here talking about Riker to Riker's face is getting a little weird. I don't know how Ortega copes. Just part of living in the modern age, I told him, knocking back my drink. Yeah, I guess. You'd think I'd have a handle on it by now. I spend half my life talking to victims wearing other people's faces. Not to mention the scumbags. So which do you make Riker for? Victim or scumbag? Bautista frowned. That ain't a nice question. Riker was a good cop who made a mistake. That don't make him a scumbag. Don't make him a victim, either. Just makes him someone who screwed up. Me, I only live about a block away from that myself. Sure. Sorry. I rubbed at the side of my face. Envoy conversations weren't supposed to slip like that. I'm a little tired. That block you live on sounds familiar.
I think I'm going to go to bed. You want another drink before you go, help yourself. It's on my tab.
No, thanks. Bautista drained what was left in his glass. Old cop's rule. Never drink alone.
Sounds like I should have been an old cop.
I stood up, swaying a little. Riker may have been a death wish smoker, but he didn't have much tolerance for alcohol.
You can see yourself out okay, I guess.
Sure. Bautista got up to go and made about a half dozen paces before he turned back. He frowned with concentration.
Oh, yeah. Goes without saying I was never here, right?
I gestured him away.
You were never here,
I assured him. He grinned bemusedly, and his face looked suddenly very young.
Right. Good. See you around, probably.
See you. I watched him out of sight, then, regretfully, let the ice-cold processes of envoy control trickle down through my befuddled senses. When I was unpleasantly sober again, I picked up Curtis's drug crystals from the bar and went to talk to the Hendricks. Chapter 21.
You know anything about cinnamorphesterone?
Heard of it? Ortega dug absently at the sand with the toe of one boot. It was still damp from the tide's retreat, and our footprints swelled soggily behind us. In either direction, the curve of the beach was deserted. We were alone, apart from the gulls that wheeled in geometric formations high overhead.
Well, since we're waiting, you want to fill me in?
Harem drug. When I looked blank, Ortega puffed out her cheeks impatiently. She was acting like someone who hadn't slept well.
I'm not from here.
You were on Sharia, you told me.
Yeah, in a military capacity. There wasn't all that much time for cultural awareness. We were too busy killing people.
This last wasn't quite true. Following the sack of Zahiche, the envoys had been steeped in the mechanics of engineering a regime compliant to the protectorate. Troublemakers were rooted out, cells of resistance infiltrated and then crushed, collaborators plugged into the political edifice. In the process, we'd learned quite a lot about local culture. I'd asked for an early transfer out.
Ortega shaded her eyes and scanned the beach in both directions. Nothing stirred.
She sighed. It's a male response enhancer. Boosts aggression, sexual prowess, confidence. On the street in the Middle East and Europe, they call it stallion. In the South, it's toro. We don't get much of it here. Street mood's more ambient, which I'm glad about. From what I hear, it can be very nasty.
You run across some last night?
Sort of. This was pretty much what I'd learned from the Hendricks database last night, but more concise and with less chemistry. And Curtis's behavior ran the checklist of symptoms and side effects like a model.
Suppose I wanted to get hold of some of this stuff. Where could I pick it up?
Easily, I mean. Ortega gave me a sharp look and picked her way back up the beach onto drier sand.
Like I said, we don't get much of it here,
she said in time with her labored, sinking footsteps.
You'd have to ask around. Someone with better than local connections. Or get it synthesized locally. But I don't know. With designer hormones, that's likely to be more expensive than just buying it in from down south.
She paused at the crest of the dune and looked around again.
Where the hell is she?
Maybe she's not coming, I suggested morosely. I hadn't slept all that well myself. Most of the night after Rodrigo Bautista's departure had been spent brooding over the uncooperatively jagged pieces of the Bancroft jigsaw and fighting off the urge to smoke. My head seemed barely to have hit the pillow when the Hendricks buzzed me awake with Ortega's call. It was still obscenely early in the morning.
She'll come, Ortega said. The link's booked through to her personal pickup. Call's probably delayed at incoming security. We've been in here only about 10 seconds, real time.
I shivered in the cold wind from offshore and said nothing. Overhead, the gulls repeated their geometry. The virtuality was cheap, not designed for long stay.
Got any cigarettes?
I was seated in the cold sand, smoking with a kind of mechanical intensity,
when something moved on the extreme right of the bay. I straightened up and narrowed my eyes, then laid a hand on Ortega's arm. The motion